You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hi, I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Ewan Lowe.
And we're in the sixth week of Epiphany, where today we're going to be discussing readings from Jeremiah chapter 17, verses 5 to 10, Luke chapter 6, verses 17 to 26, and 1 Corinthians 15, 12 to 20. So we're going to start with the Old Testament prophet Jeremiah, a prophet, bit of gloom and doom, really.
In the best tradition of the prophets.
Yes, that's right. He was a priest and a prophet called to really speak about the destruction of Jerusalem. A large part of this text is telling the people of God what they've done wrong, often framed as idolatry. They're worshipping other gods. They've forgotten the Torah. This has led to corruption and a failure of social justice is the kind of consistent themes of accusations. And here in chapter 17, we are in a section that is talking about the sins of Judah, looking towards that period in 587 BCE when Jerusalem and Judah and the temple would be destroyed by Babylon. So this prophet sees Babylon as used by God to punish, really. So Ewan, what's going on in this passage? What did you notice and what leaps out?
It's an interesting one because just the first verse, the first line really jumped out at me. You know, cursed are those who trust in mere mortals and make mere flesh their strength, and then whose hearts turn away from the Lord. But, you know, depending on where you sit in society, that may be a given.
Yeah.
But yeah. I thought it really resonated with me in the period that we've sort of been through and continue to go through for many people, where I suppose in times of crisis, it is tempting to cling on to particularly strong expressions of leadership. I think we find that a lot at the moment. Although I also wonder if that is beginning to wane a little bit.
Yep.
But certainly this idea that, you know, we have to trust in mortals and, you know, hold on to them and they'll lead us through and they'll see us well and, you know, take us through what we need to get through.
Yeah. I know this reminded me in times of crisis, which, you know, Judah and Jerusalem were in and we have been for really 2 years now with COVID, our tendency is to cling to human solutions,
yes,
even in the church, right? And this is a very strong reminder as it goes on in verse 7, blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord. The Lord becomes his trust. And we have these beautiful contrasting plant images.
Yeah, yeah. There's the shrub in the desert that is parched, and then there's the tree by the stream, which is not parched.
Yep, has deep roots into the stream. So, I mean, you could play with these images in terms of the, you know, when we know our foundations, when we know the source of our nourishment, spiritual, you know, that means even when the heat comes,
yes,
it survives. So that gorgeous image here of surviving the drought, which Australians know all too well.
Well, that's the thing I found very interesting when I was reflecting on this, that this idea of being planted and, you know, by the well, as it were.
Yep, very nice.
But this idea of being well-rooted, I suppose, you could say, and I wondered for myself, what does that look like in, you know, the third year of a pandemic or second year, whatever we're up to? It was this idea to me that if am I trusting in people, once again, or human solutions, or am I really turning to God? And that should be self-evident, because if I am turning to God again and again, well, in verse 8, I should not be anxious.
Yep.
I should be continuing to bear fruit, or you know, we as a community should not be anxious and should be bearing fruit. So I think it's a good little spiritual check.
Check in, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, that's right.
Where are we at? You know?
And if you were to preach on this, a chance to reflect with your congregation about, you know, where those spiritual roots are planted and what you've said about where our trust lies, what we really trust in, and perhaps how our spiritual disciplines might have changed. I mean, I know mine has. When church went online and you spend so much time on Zoom and things, I found myself seeking different kinds of ways of praying that was more about walking and
yes,
being away from screens and sitting still and all of that kind of stuff. So those conversations, be a walking tree, walk along.
That's right. Or find a tree and sit under it. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
There's biblical imagery for you as well. Yeah. One last thing I think that occurs to me is that, you know, we at the moment, you know, our discourse is very polarized, isn't it?
Mm.
And I think that's one of the dangers that we have where we trust in mere mortals, but others trust in other mere mortals. And yes. We're sort of torn, you know, between two cities, as it were, or two different visions of what humanity looks like. And to me, it's a reminder that at the end of the day, neither is correct. Not to say you don't have those hard conversations. I think you do need to have them. But, you know, how do we push beyond that? You know, agree to disagree where possible, and then still come back together and plant ourselves by the stream and allow ourselves to be refreshed. I think that's challenging.
Yeah. There's something in what you're saying that makes me think that this relates to the wisdom tradition of, you know, planting ourselves where the wisdom is. Mm. And here it's reminding us that is God, not human. It's not to say God obviously can't work through humans, but that avoids that polarizing reliance on human things.
And of course, you know, picked up in the book of Revelation, as you will know. this imagery used to forecast our eschatological hope.
Yep.
Of the coming future.
And a tree that it brings healing in that image. I should warn listeners that both Ewan and I work a lot on Revelation, so there's a
we've got to deliberately steer away from it.
There's a danger that we'll just bring Revelation into every conversation every podcast, you know, so you're welcome in advance for that. Right, well, shall we move on to Luke?
Yeah, let's.
So we're here in a bit of Luke. This is often called Luke's Sermon on the Plain. Because it's kind of a parallel, and I think Luke probably knows Matthew, so Luke is adapting that Matthew Sermon on the Mount. So we start in chapter 6, verse 17, with this great level place, which is interesting in itself, right?
That,
because Luke is about leveling things out. Mm. So whether it's actually historically where it happened, I personally don't care. I think we're in the realm of figurative, you know, this is doing the work of the level place is going to signify something about the leveling and the reversals that go on in this passage.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting when you think about it because, you know, I think in Matthew he's up on the hillside or the mountainside, right? And everyone can see him.
Yep.
In a level place, it's actually much harder to see someone.
Yes, it is.
It's just funny little imagery in my mind of that. Yeah, especially when it says, you know, you've got this huge multitude of people who, for all intents and purposes, seem to be from all over the place. Fairly diverse, you might think.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, we've got all the way to the coast of Tyre and Sidon. So Luke has named here places that are not in the Matthew account. In Matthew account, it's more just a crowd that have followed him, and the mountain there is to make Jesus like a kind of a Moses figure teaching the law. Luke is doing something a bit different here with the same tradition, I think. And framed it too, I mean, we shouldn't skip over, even though it's about the words and the preaching that follow, but in 18 and 19... you know, people are coming first and foremost because of the power that goes out from him in the healing and the exorcisms. And in verse 19 there, that the language, I noticed this for the first time, is very much like the language Mark uses when he talks about the hemorrhaging woman who touches Jesus.
Yes, that did occur to me as well.
Yeah.
It's that almost reaching out through people to grab Jesus, isn't it?
Yeah, so in verse 19, that they're trying to touch him because the power is going out from him and he almost like it can't be contained. And it's if you can just grasp onto him, you'll be healed. So Luke does this kind of at a few points, Jesus does have kind of supernatural, you know, abilities. Anyway, but then we get the blessings and woes. What do you make of these, Ewan?
Oh, very, very interesting. So I come from a charismatic tradition. And one of the issues that we've grappled with over the years is obviously prosperity gospel.
Yes.
Now, that may not be as much of an issue for the listeners, but it is something that you know, we've had to remind congregations over and over again that there is a theology of blessing in the text, but often there's a commensurate theology of woe or curse in the text. And you know, you don't really often have one without the other. And there's this ethic that comes with that where, you know, do the right thing and God will bless you. But if you do the wrong thing, that's not good either.
Yes.
Often ends up quite poorly for those who you know, do the things that are warned against. And in this text in particular, I find it very interesting because a lot of it has to do with wealth and poverty.
Yes, and very, very practically. So we should note again, I know I keep talking about Matthew, but I think we notice what Luke's doing here when we see how he's changed Matthew.
Yes.
Because Matthew has blessed are the poor in spirit. Mm-hmm. Luke just has blessed are the poor. Are you who are poor. Yeah. Like it's we're not spiritualizing. It's just very concrete, you who are poor.
Yeah.
It's not blessed are the hungry, hungry for righteousness, I think is Matthew's language. Mm-hmm. Here it's just blessed are the hungry, right? So again, incredibly concrete and much more about actual wealth and poverty.
And then you contrast that with verses 24 and 25.
Yeah.
Because you have to, right? That's how it's designed.
Yes.
You know, poor versus rich. It is quite bipolar in that sense.
Yes.
Right? You know, there is a clear oppositional value.
Yeah.
Poor, rich, hungry, full. You know, weep, laughing.
Yeah, these complete reversals that are very stark. And fun fact, this is the only place in the New Testament we get this word for laughing. Oh, that probably isn't going to make it into anybody's sermon, but I just feel like we should know some fun Greek facts along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But I want to return to the poverty and wealth in a sec because I actually think we need to think carefully about what Luke's doing with that. But perhaps before we do that, just to also point out that these reversals in Luke, we've already seen them like way back in chapter one in Mary's song, right?
Yep.
Where the whole thing about what Jesus will do as the Savior is lift up the humble, humble the haughty. You know, for Luke, this is kind of almost the essence of what the kingdom of God does, is this great kind of leveling out.
Yeah. Women at the front end of the gospel.
Yeah.
Speaking.
Yes, women speaking, men are silenced, Zechariah silenced.
Right.
So again, all these reversals of the normal power and cultural kind of conditions.
Christopher Hayes, I've summarized it here. But
yep.
So he goes on to talk a little bit about this in his Luke's Wealth Ethics is the monograph.
Yep.
He points that out and he says, you know, the dualistic contrasting between the beatitude and the woes very much align with, as you say, you know, the beginning of the gospel, this idea of the eschatological status reversal.
Which is about end times for people who don't know that long word.
That's right. And, and it's this idea that, well, depending on how you want to understand it and read it, but that with the coming of the kingdom, things flip. You know, God upends the tables, as it were, of the rich and, you know, feeds the poor.
Yep. And, I mean, historically, I think I haven't read Christopher Hayes' book for a while now, and we'll put a link in the show notes, although it is a kind of scholarly book, so, you know.
It's pretty digestible.
Yeah. It is. He really looks at wealth ethics throughout Luke, and they are everywhere. This is a concern of Luke's. And, again, it's about that theology and the – you know, from what we understand at the time historically, wealth was seen predominantly as a sign of blessing.
Yes.
Right? Yep. So if you were wealthy, you were doing something right, kind of mapped onto righteousness. If you were poor or sick, maybe you'd sinned.
That's right.
And so Luke is kind of transforming that, and I think we need to be careful in our preaching that we do that too, like you were saying in your tradition where that can – the prosperity gospel. I mean, it's all over the globe, right?
Yeah.
I think even in the Uniting Church, we don't have it so much as prosperity gospel, but I think there's a lot of people who come to church who still think if they think the negative one, like if they're sick or something's gone wrong.
What have I done?
What have I done is the first go-to thought, which is the reverse of that, right?
I mean, it's like the question that, you know, what did this person do that he was born blind or what did his parents do, right?
Yep, yep. And Jesus asks that question rhetorically because he knows that's what people are thinking and then, again, turns it on its head. So how else do we think about this, I guess, you know, the challenge of Luke's theology, if we take it quite literally in its plain sense, is a kind of a condemnation of the wealthy here at least. How do we interpret that? I mean, particularly some people are going to be preaching into quite well-heeled congregations. How do we make sense of this as a kind of ethic for today?
Oh, well, sell your stuff and give it away, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it is interesting because Jesus does have these hard sayings all the time. And it is difficult, particularly, I think, given that we live in a society that is in, you know, sort of fairly late-stage capitalism and we're very well entrenched in that.
Yeah.
It is extremely difficult to extricate ourselves from that and to begin asking those questions about it. And I think what I say to people now, you know, in dealing, again, with fairly wealthy people in congregations, is I say, well, one of the things that needs to be asked is about the use of wealth.
Mm.
I think that's very, very important. You know, and that's where I think verses 24 and 25 are important, because it's not just rich,
yeah,
but it's full and laughing. And I think the laughing is important as yes. as a counterpoint to weeping.
Yes.
Because when you're laughing when other people are weeping, well, that's clearly a problem. You know,
yeah.
you're not partaking, you're misunderstanding, or perhaps you're causing or perpetrating or standing yeah. by while others are suffering.
Yep.
And that's obviously, you know, a problem.
Yes.
For the Lucan ethic.
And I mean, I know I made a nerdy Greek joke before about this word laughing, but it has that sense of laughing all the way to the bank in that it's not necessarily just joyful laughter where in the Greek old version of the Old Testament where this word laughing is used, it can have a sense of a kind of a flippant or a haughty laugh. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if that kind of play, like you're laughing because your life is so good
yeah.
and you have zero care for those who are hungry. Mm. And Luke will go on like, you know, this is the gospel that has that Lazarus and the rich man parable. You know, yeah. Zacchaeus. So again, you know, you've got to kind of fit this with the many stories in Luke that are about responsible use of wealth mm-hmm. and not being satisfied with your own full belly and your rich stores when others at your gate literally are hungry.
Well, it always strikes me that when talking to Zacchaeus, Jesus does not proclaim salvation upon the house until after Zacchaeus agrees to give all the wealth back and repay people.
Yes.
You know, it's like,
make it right.
He's here. Yeah. Cool, you've accepted me, whatever. And then he says, oh, I'm going to make it right. Then Jesus says, okay, now salvation has come
to this house. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
So I think there is a very inherent challenge for all of us. You know, Christopher Hayes, again, talks a little bit about this word, you know, rich and poor. And he says, well, you know, there's a tendency to say, oh, well, you know, the poor are the disciples of Jesus, you know, because they're in this traveling circus, basically, with Jesus going around. And he goes, yeah. well, not really. They wouldn't have been impoverished in the sense of the way that the term implies.
Yes.
And I think for those of us, particularly those of us who live very comfortable middle-class existences,
yep.
there's this, it's not really a victim mentality, but we do kind of go, oh, well, we're poor too.
Yes, yeah, because we're not as rich as those people.
That's right.
But we're a lot richer than most of the world.
That's
if
right.
we go outside our immediate sphere of, yeah.
Yeah, and that's why I think, you know, to draw back to what we mentioned right at the beginning, this placing or the naming of the places is very important because suddenly it's not just this innumerable mass that is unidentifiable.
Yep.
It is Judea, Jerusalem, Tyre, Sidon.
Yes.
You know, this is the neighbourhood.
Yeah.
The backyard, I suppose, of the people who are... who are involved in this, and it's going, well, yeah, it's poverty in our areas.
Yeah.
And that looks different contextually, of course, but it's still there and it still needs to be dealt with.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to say about this passage is, and I feel like we need Kylie Crabb here for this because she knows far more about Luke and eschatology and history than the rest of us, but, you know, the way Luke talks about this or has Jesus talk about it is these are reversals that are happening already or where the kingdom is present. So it's not, I mean, the future tense is used, you will be hungry or you will be full, but there is a sense that where the kingdom is proclaimed, we start to see these reversals already. So I just want to say that because it's not about like, we'll leave it all up to God at the end of time.
Yes.
I think there's an ethical mandate here that we make sure we aren't in the group being woes. And yeah. the woe word is fun too. It's this ooi. So you can almost imagine a kind of ooi. Like it's quite.
Like the word woe.
Like the word woe. Like whoa. Yeah. So you get a bit dramatic with that.
But to come back to what you're saying, I think there is an implied imperative for all of us. And I think if you try to sidestep that, perhaps you're stepping into the woes by accident.
Yeah, that's right. You're allowing yourself to be comfortable.
Mm.
Right. Well, we can move on to Paul perhaps.
Okay.
If you'd like to know more about By the Well or any of our hosts, please visit bythewell.com.au.
So 1 Corinthians 15, 12 to 20. Now, there's 3 weeks of 1 Corinthians 15 in the lectionary. Some of you might be preaching on this and some of you might be not touching it with a 10-foot pole. But we're kind of getting into the argument here of, where we start in verse 12 is really where Paul's been heading with the key question, if Christ is proclaimed as raised from the dead, how can some of you say there's no resurrection of the dead? So he's dealing with this, some people are saying there's no resurrection. We're not really sure who the some are. I don't know if you found anything. Famously in Judaism, the Sadducees didn't believe in resurrection, but we think this is predominantly a Gentile community. So Paul might also just be coming up, you know how people come up with the metaphorical sum.
Rhetorical flourishes.
Yeah, that's right. So that you can address the issue that you really want to address. Ewan, in your tradition, how do people talk about resurrection and how?
Well, charismatically. So, you know, resurrection, it's funny because we don't actually talk about it a lot. We talk a lot about the spirit.
Yes.
You know, and that obviously just sort of sits in the background a lot to this, right? Because if there is no spirit, Paul goes on to say in the next reading, which we'll deal with in another week.
Yes.
You know, the spirit and the resurrection go hand in hand.
Yep.
We funnily enough, the resurrection is, well, it's a core. You know, you can't really, Paul himself says, you can't really move past it. You can't say no to that. You can't deny it. I think it's one of those things that I think the charismatic tradition has within it that we haven't really grappled with enough. You know, we don't have some, I'm sure some have very well, but we don't, it's not a common thing that we will, you know, bring to the table and talk about. It's always one of those things that, you know, it's taken for granted. It's dead, buried, gone, whatever. We're interested in the spirit's movement today.
Yes. And I think that's true for so many Christian communities. It's this core and central, and for Paul, absolutely non-optional part of belief in Christ is belief in the resurrection. And yet we kind of assume people know what we mean by that, which is why you might consider preaching these few weeks on this Corinthians passage, because Paul here is really advocating that, you know, all this language about the faith in vain, and he uses this word that kene, that means like it's worthless, it's foolish. Your faith is basically a joke if you don't believe in the resurrection, which might be a challenge to some more liberal Christians who and he's also talking about the resurrection as bodily, as physical. And that is countercultural for, again, his Greek Gentile audience, where the dominant strand of philosophy saw death as a way for the soul to be released from the physical body. And the physical body went in the ground and the soul went to some higher place. But that was a good thing because the soul was the good part.
That still floats around today quite a lot.
Totally, yes. And I think it does need to be refuted because of what it says about bodies.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, very much so.
So Paul is Jewish here. Like in the Jewish tradition, think of Genesis 1 and 2. We're created out of dust and it's a spirit breathed into the human form that makes us human. You know, our body spirit is enmeshed and that's the kind of anthropology, for want of a better word, that Paul presents here in terms of, you know, and that applies to the resurrection too.
Which is interesting because, you know, because, you know, there is that idea that you can get, you know, wrongfully, obviously, but you can get this idea that, within Jewish thought, they don't really like their bodies. So, well, not really.
No.
You know, like, they're not ashamed, like, you know, modesty and being ashamed are different things, for
example. Yes, yes. Modesty, because actually you value a body,
is
different to a shame covering up.
And I think there's a lot there to be thought about, particularly, again, you know, if you have a liberal disposition and in engaging with these questions around what does it mean to, you know, alter your body or modify your body or whatever. Those are some of kind of what I was picking up out of what you were saying. One other thing I found really interesting in this that perhaps we might miss is that this is actually a very deeply pastoral response from Paul.
Oh, how so? What do you mean?
Well, see, I think when we come to the latter part of this reading, when he starts talking about, you know, death and resurrection, I think that's actually quite a pastoral issue that he's perhaps trying to deal with in saying, you know how rhetoric in this world works. You yeah. throw in just about any argument you can think of to try and lift yourself up sometimes.
Yep.
But it hints to me at this question that, you know, there are people here who are deeply concerned because they haven't seen the resurrection of the dead.
Yes.
You know, what does that mean for us? You know, yep. my auntie or my uncle or whatever, you know, someone has died.
Yes.
And are they just gone? Yeah. Yep. What do we do? You know, how do I go on with my life in Christ? What happens? Do I see them again? Are they just in the ether?
Yeah.
You know, what do we do?
Yes, and in the next section he'll go on, which is next week's reading, about, you know, what do those bodies look like?
Yes.
Because he's addressing exactly that. And I think, you know, I might talk about this more next week because we're running out of time. But, you know, I think the way we talk about bodily resurrection really matters for how we talk about bodies now.
Yeah.
So that we value bodies, we value what happens to them, we take that seriously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that our physicality is part of our God createdness, you know, not to be denied, not the spirit versus body kind of dichotomy Greek thought.
Well, that's right. And there's no call to be going around, you know, sort of flagellating yourself or anything like that.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, rejoice in who God has created you to be, really.
Yep. So we'll get into some of that a bit more in terms of, you know, some other ethics around bodies and what Paul goes on to talk about. But, I mean, I think this reading gives preachers a chance to perhaps revisit some real basics around what is the resurrection. Mm-hmm. And our modern impulse, I think, is to want to ask, well, how could that possibly – we want the mechanics and the science, and it defies all of that, obviously.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's Paul's question. Paul starts with, you know, in the bit before this, you know, Jesus appeared to all these people, so that's my evidence, and we're going to move on to the what does it mean for faith.
That's right. I mean, you can't really retroactively apply scientific logic to something that is inherently not scientific, right?
Exactly. That's not his concern. So, well, I think we might have to leave it there.
Brilliant.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.